Okay, so today's reading is from 1 Samuel chapter 18 and then also chapter 20, so we'll flick between halfway through. Starting with 1 Samuel chapter 18, 1 to 9. After David had finished talking with Saul, Jonathan became one in spirit with David, and he loved him as himself. From that day, Saul kept David with him and did not let him return to his father's house. And Jonathan made a covenant with David because he loved him as himself. Jonathan took off the robe he was wearing and gave it to David, along with his tunic and even his sword, his bow and his belt. Whatever Saul sent him to do, David did it so successfully that Saul gave him a high rank in the army. This pleased all the people and Saul's officers as well. When the men were returning home after David had killed the Philistine, the women came out from all the towns of Israel to meet King Saul with singing and dancing, with joyful songs and with tambourines and lutes. As they danced, they sang, "Saul has slain his thousands and David his tens of thousands." Saul was very angry. This refrain galled him. "They have credited David with tens of thousands," he thought, "but me with only thousands. What more can he get but the kingdom?" And from that time on, Saul kept a jealous eye on David. Okay, so we're going to go on to page 292, chapter 20. I'm going to start from verse 24. So David hid in the field, and when the new moon festival came, the king sat down to eat. He sat in his customary place by the wall, opposite Jonathan, and Abner sat next to Saul, but David's place was empty. Saul had nothing that day, for he thought, "Something must have happened to David to take him ceremonially unclean. Surely he is unclean." But the next day, the second day of the month, David's place was empty again. Then Saul said his son to Jonathan, "Why hasn't the son of Jesse come to the meal, either yesterday or today?" Jonathan answered, "David earnestly asked me for permission to go to Bethlehem. He said, 'Let me go because our family is observing a sacrifice in the town, and my brother has ordered me to be there. If I have found favor in your eyes, let me go to see my brothers.' That is why he has not come to the king's table." Saul's anger flared up at Jonathan, and he said to him, You son of a perverse and rebellious woman, don't I know that you have sided with these sons of Jesse to your own shame and to the shame of your mother who bore you? As long as the son of Jesse lives on this earth, neither you nor your kingdom will be established. Now send and bring him to me, for he must die." "Why should he be put to death? What has he done?" Jonathan asked his father. But Saul hurled his spear at him to kill him. Then Jonathan knew that his father intended to kill David. Jonathan got up from the table in fierce anger. On that second day of the month, he did not eat because he was grieved at his father's shameful treatment of David. In the morning, Jonathan went out to the field for his meeting with David. He had a small boy with him, and he said to the boy, "Run and find the arrows I shoot." As the boy ran, he shot an arrow beyond him. When the boy came to the place where Jonathan's arrow had fallen, Jonathan called out to him, after him, "Isn't the arrow beyond you?" Then he shouted, "Hurry, go quickly, don't stop." The boy picked up the arrow and returned to his master. The boy knew nothing of all this. Only Jonathan and David knew. Then Jonathan gave his weapons to the boy and said, "Go, carry them back to the town." After the boy had gone, David got up from the south side of the stone and bowed down before Jonathan three times with his face to the ground. Then they kissed each other and wept together, but David wept the most. Jonathan said to David, "Go in peace, for we have sworn friendship with each other in the name of the Lord, saying, 'The Lord is witness between you and me, and between your descendants and my descendants forever.'" Then David left, and Jonathan went back to the town.
Great, thanks for reading that, James. Good to see you this evening. Do keep your Bibles open as we work our way through those three chapters in 1 Samuel, chapters 18, 19, and 20 from page 290. Before we spend some time looking at those verses, I don't know about you, but it can feel increasingly so that we live in a culture where different things can have the power or the potential to cause real division or split opinion in the world around us. Now, sometimes it can be quite almost seemingly insignificant things. So it might be the sports team you follow, whether you're the white side or the red side of North London, whether it's Basball, a fan, or getting frustrated with it, or don't have a clue what Basball's all about. Or it might be something that maybe affects a lot of us here, whether in the house you're a butter or the ketchup in the fridge or on the side or in the cupboard kind of person. This past week, I was with some friends and no one in St. Mary's, I add. They were saying how they get really frustrated when, you know, when you're packing the dishwasher and you have the kind of cutlery container thing. And the way they like to do it is you've got your four sections. And so knives go in one, spoons go in the other, forks go in the other, and maybe teaspoons or other go in the other. And so they've really taken care to do that. And then their kind of, their other half comes around and just mixes it all up and doesn't care what goes in what. Young people, if your job is loading the dishwasher, maybe find out how your mum and dad like to do it so you can get on their good books with that. Or maybe, look, one that I've kind of learnt to appreciate or still don't quite understand, Basingstoke. Is it Amazing Stoke or is it Basic Stoke? It splits opinion. And look, it's not just the seemingly insignificant things, although some of those might be significant for you. But it can be things that are much more serious. And so we can so easily look across the pond and see how political affiliation can really split opinion, can really cause division. And yet, sadly, in more recent times, we don't need to look across the pond, do we? We actually look close to home and see how that's bearing out in our own country. Or even just looking around the world and see conflicts that are causing split opinion and causing division. Different things can really split opinion. And maybe you found a similar experience when it comes to the Christian faith. Maybe you're here and you wouldn't call yourself a Christian. You're looking into Christian things. And this is kind of the process you're going through at the moment. And you're thinking, what is your opinion about all of this? And you look into it and you ask others and you find that people have different opinions about this whole Christian thing. Or maybe you're here and you would call yourself a Christian. And in your experience, you found how it's caused real division and differing opinions in your life. Sometimes you felt a warmth from others. You've been received well. Sometimes you just get a kind of apathy from people, just not bothered about it at all. Maybe sometimes you get quite an opposition to it, whether that's in the workplace or at school or college, almost feel a heat from others because of your Christian faith. Maybe even, sadly, in your own family. What are we to do in those situations then? Well, hopefully as we work through these chapters this evening, we'll see that worked out and we'll see how David responds as we see the situation with David and Saul in these chapters. So first we see mixed reactions, chapter 18, mixed reactions. We join David and Israel off the back of David's triumph over Goliath. And it's almost in verse 6, it almost sounds like one of these open-top bus victory parades as the sports team wins the trophy and brings it back to parade it to their fans, verse 6. When the men have returned home after David had killed the Philistine, the women came out from all the towns of Israel to meet King Saul with singing and dancing, with joyful songs, with tambourines and lutes. As they danced, they sang, "Saul has slain his thousands, and David his tens of thousands." The country has a new hero. In fact, everything that David turns his hand to, he's successful. Did you notice that? Verse 5. Whatever Saul sent him to do, David did it so successfully that Saul gave him a high rank in the army. This pleased all the people and Saul's officers as well. Or later on down the page, verse 14, in everything he did, he had great success because the Lord was with him. Or just over the page, verse 30, the Philistine commanders continued to go out to battle. And as often as they did, David met with more success than the rest of the Saul's officers, and his name became well known. Whatever David turns his hand to, he just finds success. Oh, don't you just hate people like that? And yet, not here. As David brings victory, so the people are thrilled. The soldiers, the officers love him, verse 5. The women love him as they return and they sing their song to him. He finds a new best friend in Jonathan, and we hear about his deep love for David in verse 1. In fact, verse 16, all Israel and Judah love David because he led them in their campaigns. Everyone loves him. Well, not everyone. There's one who's not too keen on David's success. One who maybe feels the threat of this new hero of the land. Saul, the king of Israel. Did you notice how the writer describes the feelings that Saul has towards David? First, it's off the back of the song they sing in verse 7. Saul has slain his thousands, David his tens of thousands. And verse 8, Saul was very angry. This refrain galled him. It riles him up. Verse 9, from that time on, Saul kept a jealous eye on David. There's jealousy at all his success. Verse 15, we find out he's even afraid of David. Where does this all kind of stem from? Well, it seems to be the threat that David could replace him as king. At the end of verse 8, Paul says, Saul says, what more could he get but the kingdom? It's almost as if he's thinking, oh, everyone loves David. He's so great at everything he does. He wins all these battles. He's got everything, success, popularity. In fact, he's only lacking one thing, and that's effectively being me, being in charge, being king. David splits opinion. It's almost as if he's a bit like this, a bit like Marmite. You either love him or you hate him. The people love him, and yet Saul, he hates him. And sadly, Saul's hatred, Saul's jealousy, Saul's fear of David, it isn't just a feeling that Saul keeps inside. Now, the writer shows us how this jealousy, anger, fear works itself out in action. Saul looks to act on his ill feeling towards David. Verse 11, Saul attacks him with a spear twice. He realizes that the only solution in this situation is to get rid of David. And yet he kind of realizes alongside that he can't just get rid of him. This is the hero of the land. No, it needs to be so much more subtle than that. He needs someone else to do it for him. And so from verse 17 of chapter 18 onwards, for the rest of this chapter, we see his plot to get rid of David. First, he offers his daughter Merib in marriage to David, almost on the condition that he will serve Saul and fight in all his battles. It's almost as if Saul's kind of thinking the percentage game here. If I can just get him out to every battle, surely one of these, there'll be an arrow with his name on it. And David responds with humility, saying, well, who is he? A nobody to become the king's son-in-law. Oh, not only is he successful and popular, he's a nice guy too. And Saul goes back then with his next daughter, Michal or Michelle. He sees how much his daughter loves David and thinks, I can play on that. He tells his attendants to almost butter David up with compliments. Oh, just tell him how pleased I am with him. Tell him how much he means to me, how much it would mean if he took my daughter Michelle as his wife. I'm not asking much of you. And so David agrees. And yet, the plan backfires. David continues to win his battles handsomely. And so, verses 29 to 30, the people continue to love him. And Saul becomes even more afraid of him. David splits opinion. There's a mixed reaction to him. And Saul wants to get rid of him. And yet, in the face of this opposition from Saul, we see, secondly, divine protection. Divine protection in chapter 19. And we see this divine protection work itself out in different ways or through different means. Throughout chapter 19, we see four attempts by Saul to try and get rid of David. And in each of them, across the chapter, we see four ways that David is protected throughout those attempts. So first attempt, verse 1, Saul told his son Jonathan and all the attendants to kill David. Saul now states his intentions openly to his cabinet, if you like. He wants to get rid of David. But Jonathan steps in and speaks on David's behalf. He looks to protect David. Verse 4, he speaks well of David and reasons or argues with Saul to say, no, don't do this. And in his argument, verses 4 and 5, he almost gives a rational reasoning. This man has not wronged you. He gives a moral reasoning. This man risked his life for you and for Israel when he took on Goliath. It'd be wrong to kill him. And then he gives a theological reasoning. It was the Lord who won the victory for Israel. And you were glad. And so it seems, verse 6, that Saul kind of relents from that and turns away from his anger against David. And yet it doesn't last long. Verse 10, we get the second attempt by Saul on David. Saul goes with the spear again. The third time, he goes at David with the spear. But David evades Saul's throws, and we're told he makes his escape. But his escape only leads quickly on to the third attempt, verse 11. Saul sent men to David's house to watch it and to kill him in the morning. Almost as if Saul sends his men and says, look, he'll be asleep during the night, just wait outside. He's got to come out in the morning as he gets up and goes to work. And once he's out, then jump on him. And yet this time it's David's wife, Michelle, who protects David. She warns him. She helps him escape through the window. And then she takes an idol. She lies it under the duvet and gets some hair and puts it on the top of the pillow and to pretend that he's still in bed, ill. It's amazing. I thought I was the one that kind of came up with the pillows under the duvet kind of trick to pretend to my parents that I was lying in bed. I was told after this morning to clarify that that's what I did as a kid, not now, to pretend to Rosie that I'm in bed. But it's Michelle who came up with it thousands of years ago. And so David is protected again. And then, verse 18, the fourth attempt to get rid of David. David heads to Samuel. Have a look, verse 18. David fled and made his escape. He went to Samuel at Ramah and told him all that Saul had done to him. Then he and Samuel went to Naoth and stayed there. Word came to Saul, David is in Naoth at Ramah. So he sent men to capture him. But when they saw a group of prophets prophesying with Samuel standing there as their leader, the Spirit of God came upon Saul's men, and they also prophesied. Saul gets wind of David's escape with Samuel and sends his men to go and get him. And it's almost a comical series of events that follow. The men go, the Spirit of God comes on them, and instead of capturing David, they join in with the people prophesying. And so, verse 21, Saul sends more men. And so the same thing happens to them. And so Saul sends a third group, and yet the same thing happens to them. And so finally, verse 22, Saul kind of thinks, look, if you want a job done properly, I've got to do it myself. He heads there himself to sort it out. And what happens, verse 23, Saul went to Naoth at Ramah, but the Spirit of God came even upon him, and he walked along prophesying until he came to Naoth. As Saul looks to attack, so the Lord protects. And he uses different humans to protect David. And do you notice the people that God used? Jonathan, Michelle. God uses Saul's own family to protect Saul's enemy. And God uses Samuel, but less Samuel, and more his spirit and his word to protect David. And look, I'm sure there'll be times in our Christian life, if you've not already experienced them yourself, where we will experience a Saul type of person. Not necessarily this type of Saul going to the lengths that Saul did here, but perhaps someone at work who longs to be in charge and have all the control, and so aware or afraid of any kind of threat to them. Or a friend who can be kind of jealous of other people's success, constantly comparing themselves to others around them. Or maybe experiencing someone who just seems intent on making your life tougher simply because you are a Christian. Feels like they're just out to get you. Feels like they're trying to shame you or embarrass you in front of other people. And look, whilst this can be a reality of a life looking to follow Jesus, as Jesus says in the New Testament that if you want to follow me, you need to pick up your cross. It's not going to be easy. There is also the assurance, the reassurance of protection from our Father. And look, we need to be really careful whenever we read the Bible not to draw a straight line from the events that happened there straight to my life as if exactly as it happened there, I can expect that today. And maybe even more so when we read the Old Testament, where so much happens. We need to work out what's going on for then, but also what are the principles that we read here that we can apply to ourselves. And so David was a unique person as part of God's unique plan for his people. And yet there seems to be a principle here, and seen across scripture, that we can apply to our lives if we're Christians and so be encouraged by. That in the words of Psalm 121, we can look to the Lord and find our help, trusting that he is always watching over us. That we can, in the words of Psalm 139, trust that he will hold us fast. And look, we may not experience the same type of rescue or deliverance that David experienced, but we certainly can know and trust in the same God that David knew and trusted in. And along with that same God we know and trust in, thirdly, we can know a king who faced it all. A king who faced it all. Chapter 20. You see, as we look at David and as we see someone who splits opinion of the people around him, so he points forward to one who splits opinion. If you've been with us over the last few autumn terms, as we've journeyed through Mark's gospel, we've regularly seen the differing reactions to Jesus. We've seen people love him, amazed at his teaching, crowds gathering around, wanting to see him, wanting to hear him. And yet we've also seen others who are not so keen on him, see him as a threat to them. And so as we see in David, someone who experienced opposition and rejection, so he points forward to one who experienced intense rejection and opposition from those who didn't like what they saw and what they heard, from those who considered him a threat to their life, the way they lived. And so we've seen in Mark's gospel how the enemies of Jesus, who were enemies with each other, but wanted to team together to work out, to plot how to get rid of him, to kill him. And sadly, it's easy to see that continued rejection of Jesus. Not interested in what he has to say. Threatened by the call of Jesus on their lives. the way that they want to live. And we also see in David a man who showed and committed to show a real steadfast love. In chapter 20, we get a deeper insight into the friendship between Jonathan and David. We met them at the beginning of chapter 18, where we're told Jonathan loves David. And we get this detail that he makes a covenant with him in chapter 18, verse 3. Now, a covenant is a commitment or a promise. And so it seems as if David and Jonathan are making a covenant, a commitment, a promise that they will love and look out for one another. And so into chapter 20, that covenant promise is played out further. Jonathan commits to do whatever David asks of him, chapter 20, verse 4. And so David asks Jonathan to cover for his absence at the New Moon Festival. A festival where David would have been expected to be at, but because he feels the threat of Saul, doesn't want to be at. And so he thinks, look, I won't be there, and my absence will tell once and for all how Saul feels about me. If Saul is content, if he's happy that I'm not there, then that's okay. But if Saul gets angry, then both Jonathan and David will know for sure that Saul is still set on hurting David. And throughout the conversation between Jonathan and David in chapter 20, this covenant language comes out. They speak of a love and a kindness to one another that's so much deeper and so much more than just kind of being nice to each other. The word that's used for kindness in verse 8, as for you, show kindness to your servants. And verse 14, but show me unfailing kindness like that of the Lord. And verse 15, do not ever cut off your kindness from my family. This word is the Hebrew word hesed, often translated kindness, as it is here, or in other places in the Old Testament, is translated as a steadfast love. It speaks of a love that you can totally trust in, a love that you can totally rely upon. One writer describes it like this. He says, it's not merely love, but loyal love. It's not merely kindness, but dependable kindness. It's not merely affection, but affection that has committed itself. It's a love that will last. It's a love that is completely for you. A love that is undergirded by commitment and promise. And so it points forward to the one who shows a steadfast, committed love for you. Seen in the very nature of God, a God of love, but then displayed in what Jesus Christ did for you on the cross. All out of a committed covenant love for you. And so just as David and Jonathan kind of fell back on this covenant promise that they made for each other, so we can fall back on the covenant love that Jesus has for you. And so whenever we might find times of confusion or trouble, come back to the one who has shown covenant love for you. And because it is covenant promise, continues to have that love for you. Rest in the arms of Jesus Christ. How are we to respond then to this covenant love? Three thoughts then as we finished. Here's the first. Will we trust in the one who shows us a covenant love? And so even as we go through experiences we don't like, even as we have times in our lives that lead us to question, will we trust in a God who the Bible tells us is the compassionate and gracious God, slow to anger, abounding in love and faithfulness? Will we trust? And will we show commitment? Jonathan shows an incredible commitment to David that resulted in a massive sacrifice for him. Jonathan was prepared to sacrifice his family. as he rejected his father and looked out for David. But with that rejection of his father, he was also prepared to sacrifice his own ambitions and his own future. We get this random detail in chapter 18, verse 4. Jonathan took off the robe he was wearing, gave it to David along with his tunic and even his sword, his bow and his belt. This is a really significant act. Remember, Jonathan is Saul's son. That makes him in line for the throne. And yet, as he takes off his robe, his tunic, his sword, his belt, his bow, he is effectively giving it over to David. He gives over all ambition and his future over to the one he trusts as God's chosen one. And that's played out at the end of chapter 20 as we heard it read to us. That as David realizes, or as Jonathan, sorry, realizes his father's true feelings for David, he rejects his father and goes and warns David to leave. As we know and experience the steadfast love of Jesus, the promise and commitment that he shows us, what might it look like to show commitment to him? Jonathan was prepared to give up future, ambition, family to follow God's future king of Israel. What sacrifices might that mean for us in our own lives? What might you need to give up to follow God's king, King Jesus? And then final thing, peace. The final thing mentioned in our passage, chapter 20, verse 42. Jonathan said to David, "Go in peace, for we have sworn friendship with each other in the name of the Lord." Feels like David's experienced anything but peace, and unlikely to experience anything like peace anytime soon. But this peace that Jonathan speaks of, this shalom, is such a deeper peace than just kind of a peace in circumstances. This isn't a peace that's kind of saying, oh, everything is peaceful at the moment. Nothing bad is happening. No, this is a peace that means a right, deep contentment in life. Even in the midst of surrounding troubles and circumstances and dangers. It's a peace because we know the one who holds all things in his hands, including you. It's a peace because we know the one who is for you and loves you with a covenant, committed, trustworthy love. Why don't we take a few moments quiet and think about how that applies for us, maybe one thing we'd love to change as a result of what we hear from God's word, and then I'll pray and hand back to Tim. Father God, thank you for your covenant love, that committed, trustworthy love that you show us through Jesus Christ. Thank you that we can totally depend on it every day of our lives. And so, Lord, help us to trust in you, help us to be committed to you, and help us to know the peace that comes from you. In Jesus' name, amen.
Thank you for sending your questions in. We've got a few here to challenge you, Tom.
Thank you for sending your questions in.
We're going to, we've got a couple of kind of content questions, and then we'll finish with an application. So the most voted one is this, that in these passages we read about an evil spirit being sent from God to come on Saul a couple of times. So why does God send these evil spirits? It seems like something God doesn't normally do.
Yeah, no, you're right. And it sounds confusing and looks confusing. I think it's important, if you've been with us for the series in 1 Samuel, to remember where we've been and kind of where we've come from, where we're going. And seeing as Saul's, as King of Israel, God's king over Israel as Saul. We saw 2 weeks ago how Saul disobeyed the Lord, and so the Lord's favor went from him and on to David. And from that time, there was almost, if you like, through Saul's life, you could see God's judgment on him as a result of his disobedience against him. And so in that sense, it seems that as God works out his judgment on Saul for his disobedience against him, so in this chapter, it works out in the way of an evil spirit from the Lord. And so important to say here that God and the character of God is in no way evil and is in no way the creator or originator of evil. And yet we see here, as we see in other moments of the Bible, as we see in history, how God can use evil and sin to bring about his greater good. Where do we see that most powerfully? Well, when we look at the cross. The greatest act of evil ever performed to kill the Son of God. And yet, God is even able to use that evil for an incredible good for all his people. So God, whilst never creating evil, is able to use evil for the good of his purposes and the good of his people. And I think that's what we see here, as he uses an evil spirit for the good of God's people Israel, for the good of his chosen leader, King David.
Great, thank you. And yeah, I guess we see in the Old Testament, often judgment is more immediate and physical than it sometimes is.
Yeah, and we've seen that in 1 Samuel. Places.
Yeah, so on the Amalekites and things like that.
Yeah, exactly.
Great, okay. So the next question has jumped up the leaderboard. Some say the love between David and Jonathan is an example of same-sex attracted relationship. Any thoughts on that? Is there anything that we can see in the original language that would prove that or disprove that?
In one sense, it's never stated that this is a same-sex relationship. A few thoughts on it. Here's an interesting one that I only found out this week as I was reading into this. Did you know that Jonathan is probably at least 27 years older than David? I thought that was really interesting when I read it. So how do we work that out? Let me try and get my maths correct here. We're told in the Bible that David is 30 years old when he becomes king. We're told that Saul reigns for 40 years. So that means that David is born when Saul has been reigning for 10 years. Yeah? With me? Am I with myself? So David is born when Saul has reigned for 10 years. We also read in Numbers that for a soldier to fight in the army, he has to be at least 20 years old. And we read that Jonathan fights in Saul's army in the third year of his reign. So if Jonathan is fighting in the third year of Saul's reign, he must be at least 20 in the third year of Saul's reign. If 7 years later David is born, that would make Jonathan at least 27. Does that make sense? Have you followed that? I can write it down if you're more a visual person later, because that's what I needed to do. I think that's an interesting thought to go. I think it's been perceived that these are kind of two buddies, 17, 18 years old, and what's going on between them. It's much more of a kind of almost a father-son relationship as Jonathan almost takes David under his wing and supports him. Couple of other things. It's clear in the Bible, especially in the Old Testament, that same-sex relationships are forbidden, that they shouldn't happen. And so if this is a same-sex relationship, I think the writer would know that it's wrong. And so therefore, he would either state that it's happening and it's wrong, or he wouldn't know anything about it. And yet, as we go on in 1 Samuel and 2 Samuel, it's clear that the writer knows about some of the intimate things and the sinful things that David does. And he's very happy to call it out and go, that is wrong. And so it would be weird in this situation, in such an important, significant relationship, for the writer to sort of just brush it under the carpet and go, well, we won't mention that because it looks a bit awkward. I just think it's too much of a big thing for the writer to go, we'll ignore that part. He's happy to call out sin in David later on in his life. I can't understand why he wouldn't be happy to call it out here if it was a same-sex sexual relationship. So I just think the evidence is there. I mean, it's a very common thought today that here we go, David and Jonathan loved one another, loved each other deeply. There you go, an example of a same-sex relationship. I just think it's reading into something that's not there. Here are two men, older man, younger man, who love each other in a good, healthy way, and that's played out in a beautiful, wonderful friendship. And actually, I think it should encourage us to want to see those kind of good, healthy friendships between a man and a man, or a woman and a woman, and a challenge to go, what does that look like for my life? Whether it's an older person to kind of mentor me, help me, or someone the same kind of age and stage, or a young person, that in a healthy way, a good way, I can really help and encourage and be encouraged by.
Great. Do you want to say just a bit more about what that can look like? So this, we have this question, what can we learn about Christian relationships in today's church from this passage? Any more to say on how that plays out today?
Yeah, that's a great question as we try and live this out. I think there's lots of examples in Jonathan and David, a love for one another, looking out for one another, caring for one another, wanting their best, but their best according to what God thinks is best, not best in terms of get a great job, get lots of money, get on the property ladder, but what is best for you in terms of following God's plan for your life and being obedient to him. And so that would be a wonderful thing in our Christian relationships to have someone alongside me who would go, look, I'm not sure that's for your best. It looks nice, it looks attractive, but is that for your good in your relationship with Jesus Christ? Or does it have the potential to pull you away and almost split loyalties? What does it look like to have a committed, sacrificial relationship to the Lord like we see here? So I'd really encourage you, if you don't have that kind of friendship with another Christian, to be seeking it. And it's something we long for and love to foster here at St. Mary's. Good, healthy relationship, friendships that can help one another to keep living for Jesus and to love him more.
Great. I think that's all we've got time for.